Tonight we're going to continue our study, what's called the Black Regiment. It was the pastors of the 17th and 18th century that had such great influence over their communities and congregations, much more than we as pastors do today. Today we typically sit and surf through hundreds of channels on cable television and satellite television like brain-dead zombies, and our minds become full of mush. We pick up the daily newspaper and read about who's dating who in Hollywood, or who had a tummy tuck or who had a facelift, and to us we consider that news, and that's how we get our information. But at one time, the pastor was the primary source of news and information and education in his community. From the arrival of the Pilgrims through the Puritan migration and into the 1700s, the center of every town was the local church. In fact, it physically was in the center of town with the town green in front of it. And every Sunday, the entire town would close down and go to church and hear a sermon which lasted several hours usually. There'd be an esteemed member of the congregation, the head deacon, that would walk through. And by the way, most churches had your own almost like booths with your names on the booth. So if you weren't there, it was noticeable. And there was a head deacon that would go through with a stick with a feather on one side and a thorn on the other. And if a woman happened to doze off, he would tickle her a little bit and awaken her. If a man or a young man happened to doze off, he would stick him with the thorn and awaken him. And he had the privilege of turning the hourglass. At the end of the first hour, he would turn it and prepare for the second hour. That's how preaching used to be handled. And pastors weren't only preachers, but they were the most well-educated men, having degrees from Harvard and Yale and Princeton, which were originally preachers' colleges. These men could speak Greek and Latin and English. They were well-versed in history and even the history of warfare, and were considered experts in politics. Their sermons, many times, if it was a particularly compelling sermon, would be published and spread throughout the colonies and even into Europe. Beginning with the Pilgrims, who, leaving the established Anglican church in England, had already been busy searching the scriptures for principles of church government. As they came to New England and established their own communities, they searched the pages of scripture for principles of civil government as well. Our forefathers recognized that it was God who had established the three institutions on planet Earth. God had established the home, God had established the church, and God had established human government. And just as you'd go to the scriptures for counsel on your home, or go to the scriptures for instruction in organizing and the function of a church, so too they knew that you went to the scriptures for counsel in civil government as well. According to John Palfrey's great work in 1859 entitled A History of New England, he said this: "The Puritans searched the Bible not only for principles and rules, but for mandates. And when he could find none of these for analogies to guide him in precise arrangements of public administration and in the minutest points of individual conduct, our forefathers searched the Bible for principles of government." Consequently, believing that human government was by divine origin, pastors preached annual election sermons to their congregations. They also were asked to come and address newly seated legislatures, as these newly elected representatives were told by the pastor what God expected of them, what the principles of government were, and what they were charged to do in service to their community and to their colony. According to a very thorough study done in 1928 by Alice Baldwin, entitled The New England Clergy in the American Revolution, she says that these election sermons discussed the government of the ancient Hebrews and its excellencies. Many were theoretical, concerned with the origin and the end of government, or the goal, the reason, the purpose of government. Some dealt more particularly with their own charters and the dearly won rights of Englishmen. Some, with great freedom of speech, gave practical advice to the assembly about well-known evils and desirable laws. The majority discussed in greater or less detail the qualities and the responsibilities of magistrates. Year after year, the same themes were discussed. Often the same phraseology was used. Now and again, there was an election preacher who was exceptionally direct and thoroughgoing in his discussion either of government or of the agitations of the day or of both. These sermons dealt with the matter of government. Copies were distributed widely and they became textbooks for politics. Ladies and gentlemen, our forefathers were experts on government. They were both experts on liberty and tyranny, being well-read on both subjects, but many of them had lived under both. And now in America, they enjoyed civil liberty and religious liberty, and they were zealous to protect them both. The Americans who migrated to the New World were under the authority of the King of England, but by their charters, understand this, because we're not taught this in school anymore. They were free men. They could elect their own legislatures. They could make their own laws. They could tax themselves as they deemed necessary. They could own property and buy and sell and trade with whomever they chose. And most importantly, they were free to study the Bible and worship the Lord in spirit and in truth without having to serve at the whim of the Church of England. But over time, the kings of England willfully placed themselves above the law, illegally and unilaterally, breaking the charters that were in place between the colonies and Great Britain. And understand that these constitutions, these charters, were equally binding to both parties. The king could no more break the law than could any common citizen. Consider this excerpt from a sermon preached in 1749 by the Reverend Jonathan Mayhew of West Church in Boston. He said this: "The king, in his coronation oath, swears to exercise only such a power as the Constitution gives him. And the citizens in the oath of allegiance swear only to obey the king in the exercise of such a power. The king is as much bound by his oath not to infringe the legal rights of the people as the people are bound to yield subjection to him. From whence it follows, as soon as the king sets himself up above the law, he loses the king in the tyrant and does to all intents and purposes unkings himself by acting out of and beyond that sphere which the Constitution allows him to move in. And in such cases, he has no more right to be obeyed than any inferior officer who acts beyond his commission." In other words, by breaking the charter and exceeding his defined authority, the king disqualified himself from the right to rule. And over time, the kings of England revoked the colonial charters. They replaced colonial governors with royal appointments. They dissolved colonial legislatures at their whim. They voided colonial laws. The colonists sought to print Bibles and tracts for the Indians, but the king said no. Pennsylvania was one of three colonies that voted to outlaw slavery, but the king said no. The king placed troops in America, even though there was no conflict with the Indians or France. Clearly, the effort was to subjugate the colonists. And most importantly and most preciously, the king threatened to establish the Church of England over the colonies and make membership mandatory and outlaw other religious denominations. Modern history tries to tell us that our forefathers rebelled against England because of high taxes. That is not true. England forfeited its right to govern by forsaking the law and imposing a tyrannical government over a free people. The cause that drove our cry for independence was not high taxes. It was about the loss of liberty, both civil and religious liberty. Read with me in the Declaration of Independence, where our forefathers gave the following explanation for the separation. Listen. "When a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, to reduce them under the control of absolute despotism," in other words, when the English government had demonstrated clearly and consistently that their aim was to subdue the colonies under the role of a despot or tyrant, it goes on to say, "it is their, the people's right, it is their duty, in fact, to throw off such government, such despotic and tyrannical government, and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient suffrage of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government." And then the founders listed 27 specific grievances as clear illustrations of that intended tyranny, stating that it was their God-given right to dissolve their political bonds, to throw off the yoke of tyranny, and to become a separate and equal nation among the powers of the earth. Who was responsible for fanning the flames of liberty in America? It was the leaders of the community. It was those most educated men. It was those newsmen in every community. It was the spiritual leader of every community. It was the pastors of the 17th and 18th century that believed that government was ordained by God. And get this, its purpose, like the government of Christ, was the good of the people. And since the perversion of power was an offense to God, the motto of America's independence was resistance to tyranny is obedience to God. As a matter of fact, that motto was put on the recommended Great Seal of the United States that Franklin and Adams and Jefferson had put forth on July the 4th, 1776, depicting an account of the Exodus story at the heart of the seal. Peter Oliver, who was the last British Loyalist Chief Justice of the colony of Massachusetts, called this group of American clergy the Black Regiment. As they would ascend to their pulpits, some of these pulpits would be almost straight up. You'd go up maybe 10, 12 steps and the pulpit would literally be maybe 10 feet above the congregation, and the pastor would ascend to his pulpit dressed in his black clerical robes and stir the people's hearts to liberty. Oliver said that they have been unceasingly sounding the yell of rebellion in the ears of an ignorant and deluded people. Sounds much like what the Democrats are saying about the mass populace today, does it not? So obvious was the religious influence in America's war for independence that one Hessian captain wrote in a letter in 1778. He said this, "Call this war by whatever name you may, only call it not an American rebellion. It's nothing more than a Scots-Irish Presbyterian rebellion." And British Prime Minister Horace Walpole commented to Parliament saying, "Cousin America has run off with a Presbyterian parson, and that is the end of it." It was the Black Regiment that was responsible for educating the people in government and for stirring their hearts towards liberty. So hated were these patriot Black Regiment pastors that Joel Hadley said in his 1861 work, The Forgotten Heroes of Liberty, he said, "A chaplain, when taken prisoner, is usually treated with great courtesy and consideration. But there was a class of clergymen and chaplains in the Revolution whom the British, when they once laid hands on them, treated them with the most barbarous severity. Dreading the pastors for the influence they wielded and hating them for obstinacy, courage, and enthusiasm they infused into the rebels, they violated all the usages of war among civilized nations in order to inflict punishment upon them." These preachers not only educated their community, but they served alongside the members of their community as members of the militia. Many of them were leaders of the local militia. As they would preach on Sunday mornings, then they would have lunch, and they would go out into the village commons and drill that afternoon. That's what the Minutemen were, ladies and gentlemen. They were local militias of communities. They were local congregations of church members. Let's take a look at some of these patriot pastors, and we'll just look at two or three examples this afternoon. You're all familiar with the Midnight Riot of Paul Revere. Remember, in Old North Church, there was the sign, "One if by land, two if by sea," and the British did come across the sea to the north there as they were making a move on Lexington. Some 700 British regulars came out of Boston intent on going to Lexington and then to Concord for two reasons. Number one was to bring back the bodies of John Hancock and Samuel Adams, whom they considered leaders of this rebellion. And then also try to capture a store of so-called rebel arms. Well, as Revere rode to Lexington, he rode to this particular man's house, the pastor of the church in Lexington, Jonas Clark, which happened to be where Adams and Hancock were staying. As a matter of fact, through marriage, Clark was related to Hancock. And through education, he had great influence, as well as Samuel Cooper, of a church in Boston, in educating these leaders of America's independence. Joel Hadley said this about Pastor Jonas Clark. Listen, earnestly he discussed from the pulpit the great questions at issue, and that powerful voice of his thundered forth the principles of personal, civil, and religious liberty and the right of resistance in tones as earnest and effective as it had the doctrine of salvation of the cross. Long before it was certain that the quarrel must come to blows, Reverend Clark had so thoroughly indoctrinated his people with these great truths that no better spot on the continent could have been found for the British first to try the terror of their arms and to make the experiment to subjugate the colonists by force. As word had come to Lexington that the British were in fact coming, the church bells rung shortly after 1 o'clock, and some 150 of the community gathered together in the green. Then they were dismissed, told to be on alert. Of course, the bells rang at dawn that morning, and they came back, and the shots first fired in our war for independence happened shortly thereafter. The first blood was spilled on Lexington Green. But in those hours in between, Adams and Hancock asked Pastor Clark if his men would in fact stand and fight the British regulars. Now listen to what he said. He said, this is the pastor speaking, "I have trained them for this very hour. They will fight, and if need be, die too under the shadow of the house of God." It was the influence of this black regiment patriot pastor that prepared the colonists to first stand up against the British for their liberty. In fact, after that day had happened, of course, you know that after they went through Lexington, they went up to Concord. And by that point in time, once they got to Concord, there was such a great number of Minutemen. These churches from local communities had gathered together that we actually could go toe-to-toe with the British. We drove them all the way back into Boston, killing hundreds of the British soldiers. And they recognized that they were, in fact, in for a fight. Pastor Clark stood in the Green Commons of Lexington and made this statement. He said, "From this day will be dated the liberty of the world." And boy, did he turn out to be right. Perhaps the most famous of these patriot pastors was a man by the name of John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg. He pastored a church in Woodstock, Virginia. And in January of 1776, knowing what was going on up to the north, he preached a message from Ecclesiastes chapter 3, that famous passage that begins in verse 1 with the phrase, "For everything there was a season and a time for every matter under heaven." And he preached on that text, and as he closed his message, he began to come down from his pulpit with his black robe on, and he said, in the language of Holy Writ, "There is a time for all things. There is a time to pray. There is a time to preach. But for me, that time is past." He went on to say, "There is a time to fight, and that time has now come." And he took off his pastoral cloak underneath to reveal a uniform of a colonial army officer. Books say that the church was silent as he went to the back of the doors of the church, marching through the congregation. When he hit the doors, outside was the immediate roll, rapidly beating of a drum, and an enlistment station was outside the doors of his church. 300 men from his church and that community joined the 8th Virginia Cavalry and rode off with him that afternoon or the next morning to join General Washington. And he served side by side with General Washington all the way through Yorktown. He rose to the rank of Major General, and after getting out of the military, he served as a congressman and a member of the Senate. His statue remains in Statuary Hall in our nation's capital. But he wasn't the only one. Let me read this excerpt from this work, Alice Baldwin's New England Clergy in the American Revolution. In September of 1774, an alarm spread through the country that a clash had come in Boston, and handbills were read in the Connecticut churches on the Sabbath morning. At once the clergy responded. The Reverend Jonathan Todd of East Guilford marched with 83 of his parishioners, the Reverend Mr. May of Haddam, and the Reverend Mr. Boardman of Chatham with 100 each. All that winter, many were helping their people to be ready for any emergency. Some served as clerks or officers of military companies and alarm lists. Some took part in early expeditions to secure powder and arms. The Reverend John Adams of Durham, New Hampshire, in December of 1774, went with others to take supplies from the fort at Newcastle and is said to have stored the powder under his pulpit. The Reverend John Treadwell went into his pulpit with a musket loaded and his sermon under one arm and a cartridge box under the other. I like Reverend Treadwell. And when the news of Lexington and Bunker Hill had arrived, parson after parson left his parish and marched hastily toward Boston. Before daylight on the morning of April 30th, 1775, Stephen Farrar of New Ipswich, New Hampshire, left with 97 of his parishioners. Joseph Willard of Beverly marched with two companies from his town, raised in no small part through his exhortation. David Avery of Windsor, Vermont, after hearing the news of Lexington, preached a farewell sermon, then outside the meeting house door called his people to arms and marched with 20 men. On the way, he served as captain, preached, and collected more troops. David Grosvenor of Grafton left his pulpit with musket in hand and joined the Minutemen who marched to Cambridge. Phillips Payson of Chelsea is given credit for leaving a group of his parishioners to attack a band of English soldiery that 19th day of April. Benjamin Balch of Danvers, lieutenant of the 3rd Alarm List in his town, was present at Lexington and later as chaplain in the Army and Navy won the title of the Fighting Parson. Jonathan French of Andover, Massachusetts, left his pulpit on the Sabbath morning when the news of Bunker Hill arrived and with surgical case in one hand and musket in the other started for Boston, and so on and so forth. After Muhlenberg's brother, Frederick, that was also a pastor, heard of his brother's behavior, he wrote him a scathing letter condemning his behavior, to which Pastor Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg replied, "You say as a clergyman, nothing can excuse my conduct. I am a clergyman, it is true, but I am a member of society as well as the poorest layman, and my liberty is as dear to me as any man. Shall I then sit still and enjoy myself at home when the best blood of the continent is spilling? Heaven forbid it." What a patriot this man was. By the way, his brother Frederick, who had admonished Peter for participating in this War of Independence, had a change of heart. After the British captured New York, they turned his church into a stables and threw him out of town. And then he decided that pastors should get involved in politics. As a matter of fact, Frederick Muhlenberg went on to become the very first Speaker of the House of the United States House of Representatives. Ladies and gentlemen, the British hated the rebel clergy. And over 50 non-Anglican churches were totally destroyed, burned to the ground. And dozens of others were turned into stables and to bars and to prisons and to barracks. One of the most famous of these patriot pastors was a young man by the name of James Caldwell. He was a Presbyterian minister that pastored in the community of Elizabethtown, New Jersey. Not only served as chaplain of the army, but was so zealous that he wound up serving as the assistant commissary general to secure provisions for the troops. He would preach to his congregation on Sunday and then lead men into the battle during the course of the week. The British hated him. They called him the rebel priest. Whenever he preached, he carried a brace of pistols. And when he would step into the pulpit, he would take his pistols out and lay them on the pulpit and preach his message, and then when he was done, he would put them back and be ready to move on. Amen. He's best remembered for his actions during the Battle of Springfield, New Jersey. But tragically, as the British had such hatred for Caldwell, the week before the Battle of New Jersey, as the British were invading from New York into New Jersey, as they came through his home in Connecticut Farms, they intentionally and willfully shot and murdered his wife. And he found out about it, asked for a truce. They'd left her dead body in the streets. And under a temporary truce, he was able to go back and say his goodbyes to the remains of his wife and see that she received a proper burial. Then, after grieving, went back to join his troops. And that very next week, in what's known as the Battle of Springfield, as the British were pushing forward, the American colonial army was giving the British a sound beating when one of the Patriot companies was running out of paper wadding for their muskets. Now, wadding was just as important as powder and musket balls to a soldier. Without wadding, they could not measure, they could not contain the powder to shoot the gun. And instantly Caldwell called his troops back to the local Presbyterian church. He went inside, kicking the doors in, and grabbed all the Sir Isaac Watts hymnals and went back out and began tossing hymnals to the men, telling them to tear the pages out and use them as musket wadding, using the expression, "Give them Watts, boys, put Watts in them." And that's where we get the phrase today, "Give them what for." According to Headley, says this about Caldwell, and you can see he was a handsome man. Mr. Caldwell was as earnest in the pulpit as he was out of it. He seldom preached without weeping himself, and often would melt his audience to tears. He was a man of unwearied activity and of wonderful powers both of body and mental endurance. Feelings of the most glowing piety and the most fervent patriotism occupied his bosom at the same time without at all interfering with each other. He was one day preaching to the battalion, the next providing ways and means for their support, the next marching with them to battle. If defeated, he assisted to conduct their retreat. If victorious, he offered their united thanksgivings to God, and the next carrying the consolations of the gospel to some afflicted or dying parishioner. He gave his life a year later for the cause of liberty. But perhaps the most famous of all these patriot pastors was a man by the name of John Witherspoon, who was a Presbyterian preacher called to America to become the president of Princeton. The British so hated him that they accused him of turning the campus into a seminary of sedition. John Witherspoon signed the Declaration of Independence. He was a member of the Continental Congress. He served on over 120 congressional committees, including the Board of War, the Committee of Secret Correspondence or Foreign Affairs. And as president of Princeton, he graduated 478 students who directly shaped America. 12 members served in the Continental Congress. Folks, that's 1/6 of the delegates to the Continental Congress had been trained by him. Do you think he had some influence? 49 members of Congress, 28 future senators, 37 judges, 3 future Supreme Court justices, 1 vice president, and 1 president of the United States, James Madison, were all trained by Witherspoon. They had a worldview that was molded by Witherspoon at Princeton University. While discussing in Philadelphia whether they should draft a Declaration of Independence from Great Britain, one of the delegates became timid and said that we're not ripe for such a declaration. Witherspoon says, "We are beyond ripe. We're rotten." And as some of the others pointed out, that if they signed this declaration, there would be no turning back. Witherspoon made this great statement. He said, "Although these gray hairs must descend into the sepulcher," in other words, I'm going to die one of these days, there's no getting around that, "I would infinitely rather they should descend thither by the hand of the executioner than desert at this crisis the sacred cause of my country." John Adams, our second president of the United States, had this to say about Witherspoon. He said, "He is as high a son of liberty as any man in America." As you can see, Christianity was not separated or excluded from our nation's heritage, but was intertwined with it. In fact, pastors, the Black Regiment drove the passions of our forefathers toward the fight of liberty. And if it wasn't for the Great Awakening, and if it wasn't for the role that the Black Regiment pastors had played, there would have been no Declaration of Independence, and there would be no United States of America today. Thank God for patriot pastors that fought for our liberty. And thank God for His providential hand in America.